So, to begin, our daily lives, the modern economy, the national defense, no less, requires consistent, stable, and diversified supplies of energy. Taiwan is no exception. According to statistics from Taiwan, and I'm going to use the statistics that Dr. Dong had actually provided to us, and if you hadn't already obtained a copy of some of the slides that he has generously provided, they're available in the at the front desk, that currently oil, coal, natural gas makes up a majority of Taiwan's primary energy consumption, and the remainder in terms of nuclear power and a smaller, even smaller margin on green energy make up about 18% according to the chart that Dr. Don had provided. Taiwan also depends on imports for nearly 98% of its energy consumption, and almost all of that is fossil fuels from areas such as the Middle East. The new Tsai Ing-wen government, which came into office in May of 2016, has doubled down on her party's commitment to move Taiwan towards a nuclear-free homeland by 2025. And so it should be no surprise that on January 10th, her party delivered on that promise when Taiwan's parliament, the Legislative Yuan, passed a third reading of the amendments to the Electricity Act, which hadn't been amended for over about five decades, which will phase out, among other things, among other major initiatives, it will phase out nuclear power by 2025. Simultaneously, her administration has set a very ambitious goal of increasing new renewable energy dependence from, I believe, around 4% to about 20% by 2025. Now, both major political parties in Taiwan have proposed ways to enhance Taiwan's energy security. Yet nuclear energy, which was pursued by the previous administration, is not considered by the current administration as either a safe or viable option, especially in the aftermath of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011. In many ways, Taiwan's political debate on energy security revolves not so much on the objectives, but as on the strategies for achieving those objectives. And so to help us understand Taiwan's current energy situation, where it's going, and also to get a sense of the regional landscape to explore different avenues of cooperation in new areas as well as energy sources, I'm very pleased to have our great group of speakers here today. To my immediate left, we have Dr. Winston Dong, who is the professor of global health and the School of Public Health at Taipei Medical University, where he has taught since 2008. From 2004 to 2008, he served as a DVP legislator and head of Taiwan's Environmental Protection Agency. Prior to serving in President Chen Shui-bian's government, he had a long and distinguished career with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where he was senior scientist and team leader. And I would also add that, not noted here in the bio, is that Dr. Dong was also recently selected to be a national policy advisor to the current president of Taiwan. And to his left, his full bio is I don't do justice in terms of the descriptions I just simply gave, but you can certainly refer to it on his bio. To his immediate left, we have Levi Tilleman Dick. Levi is a good friend of mine and managing director at the research consulting firm Balanced Strategic, where he is primarily responsible for portfolios including autonomous vehicles and artificial intelligence. He is the author of The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future, a fellow at New America Foundation, and served as special advisor for policy and international affairs at the Department of Energy. And now to the far left, we also is Courtney Wetterby, and she's a research associate with the Southeast Asia program at the Simpson Center. Her research focuses on hydropower, development and energy in Southeast Asia, particularly examining the Mekong River Basin and China's involvement in regional energy politics. Before joining Stimson, she was as a research associate. Courtney was at the CSIS, the State Department, Human Rights Watch, and other capacity at Stimson. So, to begin, or to kick off our discussion, I'd really like to have Dr. Dong to provide some background for us really on what Taiwan's current energy mix is, and what are the specific policies that the new government is putting board to achieve its policy goals.
Thank you, Walter. Green energy. What is green energy? Well, in August 2011, DPP chairman Dr. Tsai, he's right now the president of Taiwan. We sit down talking about so-called 10 years policy. Some people say 10-year protocol, but there are 10年政纲. That's for DPP election of he's running for president in 2012. At that time, we have two very simple words. Number one is no nuke, 2025. Secondly, energy, green energy. So at that time, I have her co-chair at a conference to discuss how is that energy we're going to do it. And in the 10年政纲, just 10 years policies, I wrote a lot of for her in that inside of the conference. Number one, is not only the non-nuke in 2025. Secondly, for high energy consumption, high pollution industry, not welcome to Taiwan. That's very important policy decision. And right now, Taiwan, she become that president in May 20, about 7 months ago. She working very hard on this energy policy she won. I can see a lot of my former colleagues involved in this kind of energy policy position issues. It's encountered a lot of problems, but most of the people there, they have a strong, strong mind. They're going to go out there and do that. So one thing we're talking about green energy, what is green energy? That's why Russell just said, we don't use a lot of fossil fuel. Like oil or coal or any others. Because the pollution is 97% of Taiwan energy is imported. That's too much. So Taiwan tried to become a self-efficient. But I just want to let everybody know one news just came out last week, making me so shocked. Who is going to be a president of the United States? Trump. But a lot of staff of Trump, they say they don't believe that climate change. I think that global warming is a Chinese government creates. So Obama decided to write an article. It's published in Science. Science magazine is a very high quality scientist. And he published this one. I don't know how many people read this already, but I just summarize two important things. He said, I consider this as a gift for Trump, I think. He said, Google, in 2017, they plan to power 100% of operation use green energy. That's Google. Secondly, Walmart. Walmart is the largest retailer in the United States. They also announced they're going to use 100% of the green energy. This is really shocked to me, I said. And then he said, from an economic side, use green energy industry create 360,000 jobs for America. But use those so-called fossil fuels that only create 160,000 jobs. That's very interesting. The article published in Science magazine, that's not easy. And I consider that a gift for Trump.
Thank you for that comparison, Dr. Dalmami. And I think it's useful to sort of look at the United States and Taiwan, mm-hmm. to sort of draw lessons on, you know, how put Taiwan sort of initiatives in context. Perhaps you can sort of shed some light for us also in terms of, what I mentioned earlier about the amendments to the Electricity Act. And perhaps maybe highlight, because it's, given the timely nature of the passage of that act, maybe what some highlights about what that initiative really, what are some highlights for that initiative?
Well, as I say, Taiwan is 97% is import, and also it's monopolized by so-called state-owned enterprise, like Taipower. Taipower is state-owned. Every state-owned enterprise behind that is a political party behind that. So, while they try to convince to do that the nuclear nuclear plant since 1970. So in the 1970s, Thai Power had a very interesting commercial. I read in the newspapers. They tell you that the reactor is very safe. You can cuddle the reactor sleep in the night, but better safe than cuddle your wife. So, what you can see at that time, people are not happy like me, you know, not happy. But all you can do, because the power behind is political power. And behind that is cash. A lot of money we're talking about. So we are talking about this Taiwan in the last 30, 40 years. It's lucky we have a President Chai Ing-wen is right now holding the power. And it's good since we are talking about how to help her, how to help her become the green energy countries. So I believe that on the table you have. We try to work on this 2025. We hope the higher solar power and wind power and other biofuel and also total include natural gas can up to 75%. The coal concern looking for clean coal. That's like the United States. If you remember the 2009, when Obama became the president of that, he said he wanted clean power. Clean power do not mean he still want to use coal. But he used the clean coal. I hope you guys understand what clean coal. Coal is Taiwan is clean from China, clean from other countries of Africa. But that coal contains a lot of arsenic, heavy metal, a lot of lead. So when they're burning, the air pollution in Taiwan is become the number one. The lung cancer become the number one in Taiwan. So I just hope it's very interesting. Harvard School of Public Health just published a report. They said their research in the last 10 years. They said if you don't curb the curve, I mean, if you don't curb, stop the coal, next 10 years, you're going to have 50,000 people die on because of this. And where does 50,000 people come from? Southeast Asia, include Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan. So everybody had to think about this is from Harvard University, School of Public Health. So I think this is very important. Let's show forward to start the green power. That's the most, it's the goal of Taiwan right now, they have goal.
And now, so you mentioned a lot of vested interest involved in sort of the reforms that are needed to Taiwan's energy industry. Now, the most visible initiative that, you know, as you've mentioned, but you've also, I think, you know, also helped us understand that it is not the only initiative, is this nuclear-free homeland initiative. But there are also concerns that this may not be a realistic solution due to the associated costs with bridging the energy gap, making that transition from, you know, displacement of nuclear energy to renewable energy. How is the government going to address these concerns?
Well, they have one question here. I cannot directly answer how, but I just want to one thing. I just want to let everybody know here. Taipower is the largest, just like a beast, and they control almost everything. So they, until today, in ladies in Congress in Taiwan, they try to amend a so-called Electricity Act. So normally, that's since 1965, and that's 50 years. Under that the law, Taipower use that. Every information they have, how they spend the money, nobody knows. So enterprise like that, you had to be liberalized to the private sectors. But they refused it. Until today, the Thai power refused to let the government to change to liberalize. So that's very important, because if you don't do to liberalize, like the United States, I give you one, Russia asked a question, very interesting. Talking about number four, nuclear power plant. Number four, how much money we have to clean up if we stop that? But I give you one example, like Long Island, we have a nuclear power plant called Xiaohan. Xiaohan, I went there twice. I went into the manager environment to go inside there and look at it. That Xiaohan is stopped in 1989 by a new state governor called Mario Cuomo. So that's, at that time, they stopped that operation. If they already finished complete, ready to order, but stopped it because public against that. Mm-hmm. But who paid the money? Who owned the money? Because it's a private sector called Long Island Power. Mm-hmm. It's not state-owned, it's Long Island Power. So they negotiated with the governor. Say, so we lost so much money. How are we going to come back with our money? We lost. So people, especially councilmen, agreed to increase the price of the electricity and the residential price 3% up in the next 20 years, 30 years. Okay, but if you're talking about $100 per month, you're talking about increase $3, and that'd be clear.
And I think that's a good segue, actually, and I want to bring Levi into the discussion right now. Because, Levi, you did a lot of work on clean energy, both inside and outside of the U.S. government. What are the hardest challenges in developing and implementing a sort of a clean energy policy, and what type of policies and infrastructure are needed to make renewable energy, a viable option?
That's a great question, Russ, and thanks for having me here. Before I get into it, I want to acknowledge one person and tell one quick story about nuclear power in Taiwan. The first is David Brown, who is a professor of mine at SAIS who actually sponsored my Fulbright application. And without David, I would not have gotten to know Russell or David Ahn here. And the second is about David Ahn. Used to ride motorcycles with me around Taiwan when we were on Fulbright together. And one day we were riding around Lanyu, and we passed by the nuclear waste storage facility there. And you know, we were like Fulbrighters, young kids, a little bit mischievous, and we're like, let's go check it out. So we drove up to the gate, and a security guard came out, and we thought, oh my gosh, we're in big trouble. And he said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, you know, we're just Fulbrighters, and we're interested in Taiwan's nuclear power program. And he opened the gate, we thought we were going to get arrested or something. He invited us in, and he showed us a video explaining Taiwan's nuclear power program. And that was right at the same time that the nuclear situation with Iran was kind of reaching a fever pitch. So I thought that was a great piece of energy diplomacy from Taiwan, and just really exemplified how open Taiwan is with its energy system and with its relationship with the United States. Now, back to the topic at hand. In the United States, really the most recent history of renewable energy was kickstarted on a state level. And the main mechanism that they use for this is something called a renewable portfolio standard. The great thing about a renewable portfolio standard is you can, what you do is you say, we want a specific percentage of our electricity to be renewable by a certain date. And then you require your utility to purchase that percentage of their electricity as renewable energy. And what that does is it allows the utility to go out and procure the most cost-efficient source of renewable energy. So at the beginning, a lot of that was wind. And in the beginning, most of the renewable energy in the United States was coming from the state of California, which had the most aggressive renewable portfolio standard. But today we have almost 30 states that have renewable portfolio standards, including one district, the District of Columbia, and I think three U.S. territories. The most aggressive of those is in California, which is a 50% renewable portfolio standard by 2020, which is absolutely huge. My home state of Colorado has a 30% RPS target by 2020. And so these are really significant numbers. And I think that has been by far the driving force in pushing for the deployment of renewable energy in the United States. There are some other policy mechanisms that you can use as well. In Germany, they pioneered something called a feed-in tariff, where they didn't actually have a goal for the amount of renewable energy that they were going to put into the electrical system, but they told producers that we're going to pay you a premium for renewable electricity. And they started with a very high premium, and then over the years that premium declines as the cost of the technology declines. And so that also has been a really powerful method of stimulating the deployment of renewable energy. And the important thing about all of that is, as you get to scale, the cost of these systems comes down dramatically. And so we've seen now an incredible progression over the last 10 or 15 years from a point where renewable energy was not economic really in any deployment scenario, except for somewhere that was really, really remote, you know, like an oil pipeline in remote Alaska or up in space where they use solar cells a lot because you can't really bring oil or coal up to space and produce electricity. But today, wind power is competitive with coal in many places around the world, and solar power has gotten down to cents per kilowatt hour. So that's huge progress, and most of that has been driven by these renewable portfolio standards and feed-in tariffs in U.S. states and in European countries.
That's great. Because part of the point of this panel is not to only talk about U.S. and Taiwan, but also the regional landscape as well. Because we want to also explore sort of regional avenues for cooperation and lessons that can be drawn from or opportunities that can be found in the region. So, can you maybe discuss what are the regional energy trends in your sort of region of focus, Southeast Asia?
Yeah, happy to do so, Russell. So, Southeast Asia is primarily, it's really driven by demand growth. So when you look at the history, it's a fairly low starting point. There are a number of least developed countries still in Southeast Asia, Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos. You've got fairly low electrification rates in a number of these countries. And you've got urbanization, industrialization, and growing population from what's about 600 million now to 750 million by 2030. So what you're looking at for the future is just immense growth. It grew about 50% for total energy demand between 2000 and 2013. Southeast Asia as a region is looking to add another 400 gigawatts or an 80% growth between now and 2040. And so what you tend to get from that is not necessarily investment in any one sector, but investment across sectors. And the energy mixes and the demand growth rates are a little bit different in each country. Some of the more developed countries, like Thailand, for instance, you're seeing about 3.54% energy growth in sort of optimistic scenarios. Of course, this all depends on economic growth. Malaysia, you get about 4%, but in some of the other countries, you see significantly more. Myanmar's annual growth rate is projected to double the consumption by 2020 from what you have today because they have such a low starting rate with less than 30% utility access throughout the country. Vietnam has historically had 10 to 12% annual growth each year, and that's anticipated to continue in the near future. And so what you essentially see is instead of just looking at a trend of increasing renewables, increasing oil, increasing coal, is across the board investments in all of these sectors. What we have right now is many countries which had sort of a historical base in hydropower, which is one of the more affordable technologies for the region, in Vietnam and Laos in particular. You had the vast majority of electricity produced by hydropower. In Myanmar, you've got about 100 gigawatts potential for hydropower. You have some hydropower potential in Indonesia and Malaysia as well, but it's mostly centered in mainland Southeast Asia. So what we're seeing now is a transition from what used to be a highly renewable portfolio towards more investment in coal, in natural gas, and in other, imported oil. So that's a big shift for a lot of these countries. Vietnam, we have coal producing about 28% of the electricity right now. It's anticipated to grow to above 50% by 2040. In Myanmar, you're just looking at a shift from export-driven growth, where they have significant natural gas and some oil fields off the coast, which have been produced primarily for export to China and Thailand in the past. And in the future, much of this development is going to be aimed at supporting domestic electricity access in the future. And out in maritime Southeast Asia, you have Indonesia, which has long been one of the largest producers of coal in the region and has previously had significant offshore oil and natural gas reserves. But in the future, they're looking to see a huge shift for that. In 2004, they shifted from a net exporter to a net importer because of the growth in demand in Indonesia. And in future, imports are likely to continue being necessary as they draw down on their reserves available. And in Philippines, and Indonesia, there's significant geothermal potential. So essentially what you're seeing is a lot of investment. One of the challenges for many countries in the region, though, is that they don't have the domestic wealth to do the investment themselves. And so there's reliance on external technological assistance, human capacity, and just bringing the money in. And that's particularly the case for the less developed countries in mainland Southeast Asia, but is still a challenge, particularly for accessing some of the more difficult to reach offshore resources in South China Sea and the other ocean territories.
You know, and you brought up a good point, which is like, the different policy goals that have to be pursued in order to have a comprehensive energy policy. And perhaps maybe in a way you've addressed this, maybe more specifically focus on how sort of different countries in the region are really balancing these different sort of policy goals like economic development, energy efficiency, and security in the region. Maybe address that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's very much dependent country to country on what they prioritize. Throughout the region as a whole, you'll see a focus on economic development, partly because of the low living standards that people have in the past. It's viewed very much in countries as sort of a political legitimacy tool. And you'll actually see this pop out very clearly in conversations. And for instance, Cambodia, where dropping the price of electricity is viewed very much as a legitimacy factor for the government, because in Cambodia, for instance, they pay the highest rates in all of ASEAN, about 24 cents a kilowatt hour compared to 6 cents a kilowatt hour in their neighbor of Laos. So there's a huge focus here on increasing accessibility for the populace and also for ensuring that you've got firm and reliable power for investment. Unlike Taiwan, which is sort of shifting away from energy intensive and polluting industries, many countries throughout Southeast Asia are welcoming investment in these arenas because they view that as a major factor for a stepping stone to move up the income ladder. And so you have low regulation on energy efficiency measures in a number of these countries, or where there is regulation, it's often not enforced. Similar for environmental protection standards, this is becoming increasingly a controversial issue for countries. Anyone who follows Vietnam may have seen a huge protest this past year over actually a Taiwanese company that invests in steel, and there is some problem with wastewater treatment that led to a massive fish die-off. So you're seeing growing concern over sort of the impacts of these intensive industries, but it's still very much a growth driver for economic development for most of the countries in the region. And I was just going to say too, regarding the energy security aspect of that, for some countries like Indonesia, I think Philippines and Vietnam, energy security and to some degree the level of dependence that they have on imports is a major concern because of how much of it comes through the Malacca Straits, how much of it is just imported, viewed sort of as a national security issue. So Indonesia in particular, we're seeing a focus on trying to produce energy domestically. In mainland Southeast Asia, energy security is often more defined as reliable access to energy, because in the past brownouts have been an issue. You just don't have the sort of flexible grid access so that if one of your plants goes down, you're running into problems with just energy access in other parts of the country, often for businesses. So energy security in some countries is more defined through the lens of just having access to energy, not so much in terms of imports, which is often defined here in DC.
And I want to shift gear and turn back to Taiwan and Dr. Don. I mean, and maybe I wanted to go back to this again, this nuclear free homeland policy initiative. And one of the points I think again about the, sort of the energy gap here is and this is an issue other economies have to deal with in terms of finding a reliable source and an energy efficient source that is also economical, is that In this initiative, wouldn't coal actually remain the sort of the main fuel for power generation as a result of sort of phasing out phasing out nuclear energy?
Well, I believe that coal will stay on as one of the main source for the energy in 2025. But several times we are talking about clean coal. Just remember, clean coal. That's different. So in other words, I have a little bit surprised the coin investigation about some Southeast Asia, some country, have hydropower almost 100 gigawatts. 100 gigawatts only hydropower, that's very good. The total electricity use in Taiwan in 2025, our goal is 28 to 30 gigawatts. The United States every year, in 2011, we have a statistical number, it's only 1,000 people in the whole country. So that's very big. I don't know which country they're talking about. But we should try. But Taiwan doesn't have that kind of natural resource. We don't have that kind of hydro, super hydro power, such big enough, because most of our dam or reservoir was designed in 50-60 years ago. And Taiwan supposed to have a lot of rain, can collect a lot of waters, but didn't do very well. Secondly, the wind power, Taiwan started doing pretty good. When I was the minister in Taiwan, EPA, I got a few companies from Denmark to do recently. But then we got a problem here. Where is the wind power you're going to set up? Inland or ocean? The inland, where are you going to set it? Just like a solar power. Solar power, where are you going to put the solar cells? Right now, finally, we compromise. You can set up a solar power in landfill. That's technically it's illegal. But now, they finally compromise. So, this is one thing, the wind power, again. The wind power will come a lot of NGO comes against us because Taiwan right now has a problem with also white dolphin. White dolphin. Dolphin is a so-called endangered species. In the whole world, we only have a white dolphin close to Guinea. So if you set up that wind power on the ocean side, that is going to kill most of them. So right now, still they still try to assess how is the best. Secondly, wind power concern is the designing is, we have a Denmark people come to help, but the designing, the weather is different from here in Taiwan. Taiwan have a lot of typhoon, and they also have a lot of different type of weather, like a rain or like a wind, strong wind. So this kind of assessment, they're still working on that. I hope that by 1 or 2 years they can have a much better accomplishment on this campaign. I cannot answer this because in my paper at least all the difficulty we know. When we working with Dr. Tsai in about 4 or 5 years ago, we have a lot of experts to come to help. And most of people the answer is Taiwan not easy to do that. But I think a lot of people a lot of work hard right now is they can overcome this. But we need a little time. So pass the law is most important. You know why? Because the law can give you a chance to liberalize the kind of private sector. They can sign agreement with the businessman, so-called PPA. PPA is purchase the power for agreement. Just like Google, just like Walmart, they use great powers. Just like Midland just we just make an announcement, 100% of the train is going to use wind power. 100% of the train in the country is going to use wind power. Midland is almost the same size as Taiwan. So I think they can do it, Taiwan can do it too.
Now, and before the seminar started, we had actually, we were talking earlier, and he had mentioned that that Taiwan imports a bulk of its coal, actually, from China. And so, like in a discussion about energy cooperation, I think we can't avoid the topic of what is the current status of sort of Taiwan and China cooperation on energy issues, and how do you see that that relationship progressing in the future?
Well, if you remember one example of Russia and Ukraine, they bought natural gas from Russia. Politically, Russia always say we can stop it. Not going to so China, they can stop the coal to Taiwan easily. Okay, so that's I have one series because in my paper here, I showed the natural gas in 2025. Hopefully, Taiwan can reach about 50% of the energy. 50%. Where does come? We're going to buy from the United States because share gas is right now Taiwan can pay only 25% of the price, 25% of the price. It's cheaper and also more secure supply. So that means between these two countries, United States and Taiwan, not only trade partner. So they can be a good trade partner. So I try to convince the people in the government improve the U.S. and Taiwan relationship, try to encourage this. Because 2013, I think about 3 years ago, we had tried to buy U.S. natural gas, but only taste, not too many, only me or two. I think that's not too much. Secondly, in Taiwan, do not have too much public. You understand the harbor? Yeah. Not too much, only Kaohsiung. And also others. I think maybe in this stuff. I cannot know this question. So they have to be build more harbors in Taiwan in order for natural gas can ship to Taiwan. But I believe that the shale gas with other people in the United States expect to happen, especially Donald Trump government. That's not very good.
I want to focus a little bit more on the future here right now in terms of really looking at the energy, the most energy consuming industries, and one of it, of course, is the automobile industry, and something that going forward, I think Levi, you can really add some insight into this, because you've written a book, the Great Race, about the future of autonomous vehicles. And you wrote and you made a compelling case about how basically the future automobiles is autonomous, especially autonomous electric vehicle. Maybe can you provide us with some overview of what the technologies are involved to make this sort of revolution you speak of a reality?
Sure. So with autonomous vehicles, there are really two challenges, and perhaps the bigger challenge is regulatory. The second challenge is a technology challenge. There are kind of two approaches to autonomous vehicles. The approach that most automakers are using is they use a very expensive sensor that's called a LiDAR, and it's like a laser-based radar system. That essentially what it does is it shoots out millions of laser beams a second, and then it times how long it takes the laser beams to come back and hit the sensor. And that's how it paints a picture of the 3D world. So it's kind of like if I threw a tennis ball at the wall, how long it took to come back, and that would tell me how far the wall was away. And that's what most automakers are using. But Tesla has a different approach. Tesla has not used a LiDAR sensor, and the reason they've done that is because they can bring down costs significantly by doing that. So what they use is they use a little video camera that's kind of similar to the camera that you might have in your iPhone, and they pair that with sonar and radar systems. And they have very advanced vision recognition systems that allow the Tesla to essentially, now to a certain extent, but in the future, hopefully completely drive itself based on that vision recognition system combined with the data fusion from the radar and sonar sensors. So from an energy security perspective, why is this important? Well, it's important because the economics of autonomous vehicles are going to drive the economics of what we call transportation network companies, companies like Uber and Lyft in the future, that are going to be responsible for an increasingly large proportion of the vehicle miles traveled, especially in highly urbanized areas. And Taiwan is one of the most urbanized countries in the world. So you can see companies like Uber providing a significant amount of the transportation to a country like Taiwan. And the importance of autonomous vehicles is that they allow these TNCs to get rid of what is by far their biggest cost, the driver. You can buy a car for $20,000 and get a very decent automobile, but in San Francisco, you're paying an Uber driver $90,000 a year to drive that car. So even if autonomous vehicle systems are relatively expensive, say they cost $10,000 or $20,000, within a very short period of time, you're just printing money with that autonomous vehicle system. So they're going to be a huge enabler for a transportation model that is based around transportation network companies. Now, bringing it back around to energy security, the reason that that's important is because the TNCs are going to want to utilize the resources that they own as efficiently as they possibly can. In the United States today, we have about 1.5 passengers in your average vehicle. But a transportation network company wants to put many more people than that in each car that they own, because that's how they can maximize their revenues. So if you can put three or four people in that car instead, you're dramatically reducing the amount of energy that's consumed by that vehicle. In fact, every single time you put another person in the car, you're effectively changing the denominator on both your energy emissions and cost equation. So per person mile traveled, if you have three people in the car, you're emitting about one-third the amount of CO2 as you would if you had one person in that same vehicle. Just one last thing. So for Taiwan, from an economic standpoint, this is important because Taiwan imports about 1.1 million barrels of oil a day, and that equates to about $20 billion of oil a year. That's at $50 a barrel, but if oil prices go back up again to, say, $100 a barrel, which is not at all inconceivable, that becomes a really significant drag on Taiwan's economy. And so the more the Taiwanese government can encourage the deployment of companies like Uber and Lyft within their economy, the more prospects they have to reduce that drag on their current accounts. And my understanding is that Taiwan is actually fairly far behind in the deployment of TNCs at this point in time. So that would be an interesting place for the Taiwanese government to focus.
That's a good point. I mean, I want to ask a communal question right now before opening it up for Q&A from the audience, and that is, international cooperation on energy and technology challenges is a way for to enhance energy security for resource-scarce countries. What are some regional energy cooperation mechanisms in the region, and what opportunities are there for Taiwan and the United States to cooperate?
Before I start, I have one simple question that I
gotta
ask. In the last couple of weeks, I asked Taiwan some professors to look at the data for me. Increase the GDP 1%, how much consumption of the energy, 1 gigawatt. Three professors, two is from the National Taiwan University. They cannot do it. They say that they have to look for another professor from the academic. See what very hard. Finally, give me a table. I don't understand that. The table, I have no idea. But later, I want to understand that from you.
Can we do this afterwards?
I'm very curious because 1 gigawatt, 1 gigawatt is pretty big. It's almost 1 billion of a watt. So how much consumption in order to push the GDP up?
Yeah, so I think that right now we're at a really interesting time in the development of the energy economy, because up until now there's been a pretty strong linkage between the growth of GDP and increases in energy consumption. But if you look at something like the transportation system and the scenario that I just described, you can easily foresee a situation where you're providing many, many more services for much less energy. Right? So if rather than having one person in one vehicle, you have one vehicle. And another interesting variable to add into that is, in the United States, a single vehicle is usually utilized around 4% of the time, right? So if rather than having one person in one vehicle 4% of the time, you have a vehicle that's used 50 or 60% of the time and generally has four people in it, you can see that being much, much, much more efficient. One car could potentially replace 50 or even 100 vehicles, and you could have a system that is much more efficient from a carbon emissions perspective than even an electric vehicle system would be, without even changing the powertrain of the car. Because if you do the math, generally the emissions of an electric vehicle would equate to somewhere between 30 and 120 miles per gallon on a carbon output basis in the United States. But if you're putting four people in, say, a 40 mile a gallon vehicle, then that equates to about 160 miles per gallon So that's a big deal. So I think that there are terrific opportunities that you can pursue by utilizing technology solutions to increase GDP without increasing energy consumption very much right now. Another great opportunity for the Taiwanese economy is just this overarching transformation of the automotive industry away from an industry that's mostly focused on manufacturing towards an industry that's focused on sort of in-car technology and design experience and towards mobility. And I think that could be a huge opportunity for Taiwan.
A lot of technology we still have to learn from other countries. As I mentioned before, wind power, Denmark have a lot of experience. And the United States have a lot of more experience for just especially for natural gas. I went to Long Island, Shoham Nuclear Reactors. They told me the two things. One is, we shut down this one, but Taiwan, because they converted into natural gas power plant. So they asked me if Taiwan needed technology help. They are ready to send people to do it. Maybe I could have one very short interesting story about the Shoham. The manager told me that September 11th, they are terrorists. Original target, that nuclear power plant, instead of World Trade Center. And the manager, he said that those people, they don't have information. This power plant already shut down in 1989. So actually, that power plant become a nightclub. They have a lot of high school students can have a party there. No radio free too. So it's interesting. Number four, Taiwan can do the same thing. They don't have to worry about how to demolish that plan, how much money it's going to cost taxpayers' money. So, I'm sorry, I just said
So in the context of Southeast Asia, I think one of the best opportunities for Taiwan and U.S. to potentially cooperate is through separate bilateral cooperation, if you will, with ASEAN. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The United States already has agreements to do technical and human capacity training with ASEAN as a whole, as well as through individual USAID, US Army Corps of Engineers, State Department, Department of Energy programs with many of the individual countries. And as one seems to be discussing sort of the technical capacity angle, that's an area where the United States has a lot of strength. But it's also an area where relative to Southeast Asia, Taiwan has some strengths as well. There's just broadly throughout many of the Southeast Asian countries, a need for better international training, better understanding of energy efficiency technologies, of getting beyond just the energy issue to environmental impacts of environmental protection and how to sort of address the energy environment nexus that is a major factor in development for the region. And that is an area in which Taiwan has relative strength. And I know that Taiwan, through its sort of new southbound policy, is increasingly supporting technical exchanges, people-to-people exchanges with Southeast Asia and other countries. So that could potentially be one avenue where Taiwan and the United States could do coordination, because the United States does those sort of exchanges, but it's often very short term, or it's often that the United States might send trainers who parachute out to the region two or three times a year, and that's all the engagement that they have because of limited funding. So doing better coordination with Taiwan and with other development partners, whether that's multilateral banks, Australia, Japan, or Korea, any other countries that are engaging on energy issues in the region, doing a better job of coordinating so that people in the region who are being groomed as potential leaders within the energy sector can get multifaceted training and ongoing training, because that's a major challenge for many of them. Their governments just don't have the domestic capacity to do up-to-date training in renewables, for instance. It's not a focus in many of these countries, so they have to go abroad for that. So better coordination from development partners would be a major opportunity there.
That's an excellent point to end on, and I would just add that the United States and Taiwan has signed a global cooperation and training framework in 2015 in areas where the two sides have agreed to leverage Taiwan's experience and expertise in areas where it's excelled in such areas like global health alleviation and democratization. And I believe energy cooperation is one element within that, and I think your point about the confluence of the new southbound policy with these needs in Southeast Asia are very complementary, and I think it's an excellent suggestion to
to round out our discussion. And so I'd like to open this conversation up to Q&A. So if you can please state your name and your affiliation, and then and ask your way to question.
Government Energy Office. I work a lot at state and local government level in the last 20, 30 years. There's been quite a bit of discussion about different types of technologies, energy technologies that Taiwan is looking at. There's also been some discussion about the difference between what's needed in terms of electricity production and then what's needed in the transportation sector.
I guess my basic question is whether or not there has been, in the region as well, a comprehensive energy study done in terms of supply and demand, and also whether or not there have been any efforts to develop a comprehensive energy plan,
or even maybe in a more global context, a comprehensive climate change action plan, which many countries are doing now.
I can touch briefly on the regional aspect of that for ASEAN, at least. There have been a number of studies done, mostly by the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the IEA, on sort of comprehensive energy assessment for the region. And there are a few projects that are currently being worked on, often in coordination with development partners, that would help address sort of the regional, I guess, efficiency angle of that through energy trade, mainly in Southeast Asia, mainland Southeast Asia. Where just building out the grid would help avoid overcapacity in each individual country, because right now the planning is very separate. But apart from those studies and sort of ASEAN coordination, which has been slow, there really isn't a significant coordinated effort. And partly that's just due, you know, the island nature of the Philippines and Indonesia makes it somewhat difficult to look at the grid training aspect of that. But yeah, I think that's an area that there's a lot of opportunity for improvement, particularly with the climate change angle. Many countries in Southeast Asia do incorporate climate change concerns into their long-term development plans, but it's often dependent on support from the international community. So for instance, the Philippines had promised that if they were able to get international support for building up their energy sector, then they'd be able to do a lot more with renewables, 20% rather than something like 10%, which is what they do domestically. But again, that requires more international support on the financial and technical side, so it's a challenge.
Do you want to maybe comment a little bit on sort of Taiwan's energy action plan? Maybe I know you sort of discussed that actually in the course of your presentation.
Well, actually, I summarized a couple of things. I mean, that's probably interesting. Well, besides amend the law, so-called Electricity Act in 1965, and last week it just passed it. But that's the first step. Second step is they want to reorganize the Thai Power right now. Because Thai Power, as I say, is at least you have to be cut, at least cut the half of it. So to improve that management skills, because low efficiency, very low efficiency in the transition between the wires. Mm-hmm. So, and then they want a clean coal power. So a lot of people try to assess how the international trade cooperation with other countries, if we can supply clean coals. So they want to push more supply with the region from the United States. So this is one of the goals they try to do that, include the wind power from European countries, and also the hydroelectricity, biofuel, and the geothermal issues. Secondly, they try to encourage between the business, because they try to, because the energy supply is stayed on for so many years, almost 50, 60 years already. Right now, one of them gave up some of their power, and to now it's back as political power. So, they try to encourage the private sector to run green energy, and to ask that the business try to sign up PPA, power purchase agreement. That's like Google or Walmart, I just mentioned. So they try to use that agreement and give some favor. So this new law just passed last week. I changed the name, not Electricity Act. I changed the name to become so-called Green Energy Priority law. So in the whole law, the pictures, is everything they try to favor the energy manufacturer. So that's a good sign to me. It's a lot of direction is correct. So the other one is normal. When I was the minister in the EPA, I have to keep to tell everybody where the short sleep in the summertime. Cut down the energy, electricity, air condition between 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. And but doesn't work. And now the new government say it's okay, you don't work. 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., the price is going to change, not the $12 per watt. We're going to change the price to $25 per watt. Are you going to do that or not? You can spend the money, or you don't want to spend the energy. So that's a kind of a couple of strategy, I guess, somewhere else. So, but this is, you need a strong leadership.
Right. And I was just going to ask, I mean, just add, and perhaps you can address it if you don't, or choose not to, but I mean, is this a politically wise decision on the part of the current administration? Because as you mentioned, this is certainly not going to be popular to sort of raise the cost on you know, the cost of energy use. And so, would you care to comment on that?
Well, I have to tell you everything. Political situation in Taiwan is very complicated. Very, very complicated. I cannot answer with one single word. Especially everybody, the political, everybody have their own. I would like to say it's a very greedy, selfish, their own in the political situation. So I'm not really sure, but you have to use a little bit the advantage of, right now, the ruling party is called DPP. DPP have a Congress majority right now. So hopefully we can use more advantage on that, try to overcome a lot, especially like this so-called Electricity Act passed last week. It's not easy because that involves a lot of business people, a lot of business conflict their interest. So but finally, through the Congress, it passed it. But a lot of right now, the political sphere, I'd like to say,
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that candid response.
Russell, can I just make a quick comment on that? So I think Dr. Deng's focus on efficiency is really important. You know, sometimes we call efficiency the fifth fuel. It really should be called the sixth fuel, but this fifth is coal, oil, gas, nuclear, and efficiency, and we should put renewables in there as well. But you know, when the Japanese do energy planning, they always show what proportion of their energy mix is going to come from various sources. And one of the sources that they include is efficiency. And they actually put that on the bar graphs. And this kind of dynamic pricing that Dr. Deng is talking about, that's a terrific way to incentivize efficiency. That's a really important element of energy mix going forward. And I think it's the same story for transportation as well.
Yeah, I just give me 1 minute, I'd like to say one thing. In 2008, I went to Luxembourg. That country, a small country, they have one small city called Reykjavik. The city mayor is very strong leadership. He decided not going to any energy except use biofuel, use cow, what's it called, and horse manure, and use oyster. They mix up become created that energy, and solar power for each house is solar power energy. So this 2000, they invited me to go to their high school gym. I can see their high school student. They have such a big, bright electricity. We just mentioned about efficiency. They said that they had efficiency of 96%, 95%. That's pretty big. Taiwan, I think, is maybe still less than 80%. So that's very important. It's more kind, small city.
Thank you. Really interesting set of presentations. My question has to do with the incentives that the government in Taiwan has built into the electricity law or whatever other requirements there are. What are the incentives, the principal ones, that are being used to encourage companies to develop green energy sources? I asked this question against the background of Levi's comments about what has proven in the United States to be the most effective policies for getting companies to actually build energy sources, which are more expensive and hence going to put costs on either the government through taxes or to consumers through increased energy costs.
In the center, I just say that politics are complicated. The most that's the local politicians and also how they coordinate this supplier. And one city in Taiwan is called Pingdong. Pingdong, I helped them back in 2008 when I was the minister there. Try to use this so-called peak waste to create that electricity. They did right now, pretty good. But Pingdong is a county. It's normal DPP can easy to control that. So not too many problems for there. They develop hydropower, they develop other electricity supplier. But other county, not easy, because the incentive and country. So in this law is if just passed last week, they have some kind of say. If more than 10% of your investment, then we're gonna ask that price is much lower for electricity than Taipei power. So that kind of incentive encourages people to form a company as a green energy company.
Oh, so subsidizing private.
Subsidizing the private
electricity company generating.
That will compete with Taipei power.
I hope I stay here today. Taipei is disappearing. I'm serious. I invited a couple of experts from the United States to Taiwan and talked to Tsai Ing-wen on these issues. We asked them, just let us know what is accounting system in the last 50 years.
Well, I was just going to ask, who owns the grid in Taiwan? Because in different places, like in the U.S., you generally have the utility that also owns the transmission. In China, you have State Grid and Southern Grid, and they own the transmission, but not the generation. How does it work in Taiwan?
Transmission, you're talking about?
The power lines.
Power lines.
Yeah.
That's state-owned.
State-owned. Okay.
Yes, state-owned. So that's why this law tries to encourage the private sector to handle this. We call it liberalization. But Taipei Power, they don't. They have a union. They're against that. They say it is 6 to 9 years. So I just say I'm very disappointed with people's perception of it. 6 to 9 years. 2025 is the year. We try to reach the goal. How can we reach the goal without this?
Maybe time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm from the National Innovation Research. I had a question on, you mentioned potential for U.S.-Taiwan cooperation in natural gas exports. I also wanted to ask kind of the composition for what you see in terms of natural gas outlooks as I kind of understand that, you know, there has to be economic feasibility for U.S.-Taiwan energy trade. And without it, it's not going to happen just because the United States doesn't, even if the United States government tells its energy industry to export, unless there is a commercial component to it, that doesn't happen just because that's the division of powers that we have here. So I kind of wanted to ask about what you see in terms of natural gas demand outlook in Taiwan, because I think that would determine a little bit more of what U.S.-Taiwan natural gas trade could look like. Thank you.
Well, I'm quite optimistic. I give you, I'm not a major in economics or major in engineering. I'm a public health person. So Taiwan and the U.S. signed an MOU in 1996 until today on what environment. Yeah. So include that MOU includes a cooperation not only from U.S. EPA to Taiwan, including NASA, NASA, include other federal agencies. So I'm very optimistic on this because this United States is very, it's one of the top friendly in Taiwan people. They consider American is the most welcome people in Taiwan. So I believe that trade, especially natural gas, its problem is not Taiwan, one of the U.S. It's U.S. can they do it? I think you understand what I'm talking about. The shale gas right now got some opposition from a lot of people, especially environmental people in the United States. Okay, so especially natural gas, if Taiwan want to buy 25% of the price, only 20%, that means only one quarter of the price. It's much, much better than a lot of us, natural gas and electricity price. Mm-hmm. So that's why in my map I say, hopefully 2025, we can increase to 50% of our natural gas. And natural gas, yes, we have created a lot of pollution.
I would just add, Sarah, that in general, if you look at the way Japan has approached U.S. natural gas exports, you've seen sort of a combination of market incentives, geopolitical incentives, and game theoretical incentives, right? So part of what the Japanese are doing is they're trying to use the United States as a cudgel for their other natural gas suppliers to bring down the price a little bit, right, or significantly. Part of what they're doing is using the United States as a very secure, friendly source of natural gas imports, and then partially they're fulfilling their market demand. So this is a very complex set of dynamics.
All right, well, with that, I think let's join me in giving our panelists a round of applause. And stay tuned for our next event, which will take place on February 1st. It will be a book talk by Misha Auslin from the American Enterprise Institute, who has just recently published a book called The End of the Asian Century. So it should be a very exciting and provocative talk. So. Stay tuned for the event announcement, which will go out later today. Thank you.